Welcome back to the Coffee and Heroes podcast. This is episode 238 and the second part of our interview with the fantastic Jim Zub. This time round, we talk compendiums, Rick and Morty versus D&D, and Jim's work at Marvel, including Thunderbolts, Uncanny Avengers, Avengers No Surrender, Avengers No Road Home, and Jim's fantastic impersonation of the one and only Al Ewing.
Well, just from a retailer point of view, I mean, Image have started recently doing compendiums for a lot of the titles that came out back then. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing a Deadly Class compendium, a Black Science compendium, a Nailbiter compendium. Are there any plans for maybe a compendium for Skull Kickers?
Yes. So I don't know the exact timing of it. Weirdly, I think we might do a Wayward one first because okay. It's the 10th anniversary of the launch of Wayward, which makes me feel very old. So Wayward launched, I want to say August of 2014. And so we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of that series. And I would love to have a big phone book, rock and roll. I want that book that's big enough to drop off a third story landing and kill a child. Like, I want one of those big doorstop of a book. That'd be fun. And then it would, from there, it'd be easy to justify doing a Skull Kickers one. I know what we would call the Skull Kickers one already. I've had it in mind for years. We would have to call it Skull Kickers Gut Buster. And it would be like, that's got to be the name of the compendium because it just feels very appropriate. Putting them all in one kind of volume. For you as a retailer, do you find those skew? Do those do well because it's all in one?
Very much so, because there's certainly Image titles from that era anyway, that there might be one or two of those books that are out of print. And mm-hmm. as a retailer, I always have it in the back of my mind. If we have, say there's an 8-volume set of something and I have the first 5, but right. I know I can't get the last 3, I will maybe shoo people away from that book.
Right. Instead, the worst thing is when it's a volume in the middle that goes out of print or whatever. You're like, we have 6 volumes, and you're like, volume 3, should we reprint 1,000 copies? You're like, you're going to lose money on it, essentially.
Yeah.
But not having it available means no one reorders. And so you're in this bizarro state of like, you're like Schrodinger's book. Like, you exist and you don't exist. Like, people don't know whether to order it, and they got to try and find used copies or it's just a huge pain. And so the nice thing is, if it's all in one book, it is or it isn't. I know some people do those omnibuses and they include all the bells and whistles, like all the back matter and all the stuff. And sometimes, because they just get so massive, sometimes they just do the story pages. They're just like this, you know, you can save 100 pages on that thing. So it gets, I mean, it's already tough to manage. Putting one of those in your lap and trying to read through the whole series can be a bit of a thing. I wish you could do like a 3-volume slipcase kind of a thing, so you'd still have a manageable size book, but mm-hmm. the market seems to want just one big brick.
I think we just live in such a binge culture now as well. People are used to TV shows dropping seasons all in one go, things like that. Yep. But it's not only that, they're tremendous value. I mean, I mentioned to someone last week, so Deadly Class is one of my personal favorite series, and the compendium for it's coming out. It's a $54 book, and that's the entire run of Deadly Class.
How many issues is that?
That's around 40 odds. So,
wow, for, you know, $54.
You know, you look at the Walking Dead compendium, $60, 48 issues at a time. Same with Invincible. So it's they're tremendous value, and they're an easy sell because you can say to someone, look, this is the complete book. This is the whole run.
I think what's great about that is, you know, for me, because what's crazy to me is I haven't done a creator-owned fantasy book since Skull Kicker, right? And now I'm the guy that's done whatever, you know, Pathfinder, Samurai Jack, Dungeons and Dragons, and Conan the Barbarian, and Red Sonja, like just a who's who of kind of fantasy characters and concepts. And so, yeah, having that compendium out there is a no-brainer in the sense of, oh, if you like Jim's stuff, if you love his Baldur's Gate comics, and you loved all the different things he's done here, this is the original. This is the unfettered, moronic, you know, kind of Deadpool by way of Dungeons and Dragons that is Skull Kickers, you know? And that's kind of, for me, that's very appealing. You know, we did a Kickstarter a few years ago it was supposed to be the 10th anniversary, but by the time the book came out, it was like almost 12th anniversary, but that's classic Kickstarter-y kind of stuff. And we did a brand new story. We got the original team back together. And it was fascinating to see how Edwin's art style had changed and Misty's colors had grown more refined. in my writing, I was like, can I even get into that headspace anymore? And then you get like five pages in and you're like, oh yeah, I know what these are. Oh yeah. Okay. We got it. And it was very fun. It was like putting on your favorite old shirt from college and you're like, it's a little ratty on the edges, but man, it's my favorite. You know, it's great. Yeah, it's really fun stuff.
And you mentioned there, Jim, you mentioned there your Baldur's Gate and Dungeons and Dragons comics that you've done. And in addition to the pure D&D stuff that you did, you also penned Rick and Morty versus D&D.
That's right.
And we were lucky enough to speak to Kyle Starks last week. He's a man with a notable Rick and Morty pedigree.
Yes.
How did that particular crossover come about?
That's a super weird one. So what happened, from what I heard later, I think some of the editorial staff from Oni Press went out for dinner with some of the editorial staff from IDW, and they were just hanging out having drinks or whatever. And then someone said, well, if we're all here, we clearly have to plan a crossover. And they just started throwing stupid, you know, their biggest titles out at each other. What could you do with? And someone literally said Rick and Morty Dungeons and Dragons, and everyone laughed and went, oh, that would be so messed up. And I guess it stuck in someone's head, because the next morning, Sarah Gatos from, I think at the time she was with IDW, and then she ended up switching over to Oni, which is hilarious. She came over to my table and she said, you know, we brought this up at dinner last night. Is this something you might be interested in pitching on? And I said, sure, but it'll never happen. And she's like, what do you mean? I said, you're talking about Wizards of the Coast's Crown Jewel, right? And Rick and Morty is Adult Swim's Crown Jewel. And the D&D people aren't going to be able to take the piss with their biggest IP. Like, they're just not going to be able to let you do the kind of brutal takedown sarcastic thing that you would need to do to make it work. But that being said, it would be a scream. I would be interested if this is real. And it took them like 8 months to negotiate the contract with both companies and then both publishers. And then somewhere in the mix, I think Charlie Chu and Oni reached out to Pat Rothfuss, who was a really big fantasy author. And he had kind of a take on it, because he was obsessing over Rick and Morty at that time. And literally a year later, because it was Emerald City Comic Con was when Sarah approached me. And then we had over email been introduced, and they said, would you be willing to work with Pat on that first miniseries? We got on a phone call, and Pat and I talked about growing up playing D&D and what you needed to do in order to make that book work. And we were very much in sync in terms of, we wanted to make it a really good Rick and Morty story that you know, instead of just the cynical, sarcastic parody, there had to be something intrinsic that you could say about Rick Sanchez and Morty and Summer and just Jerry. Everyone had something that we could sort of reveal about themselves with Dungeons and Dragons and with role-playing and tabletop gaming as a whole. And that if we wanted it, the gut punch of the emotional stuff that makes the best Rick and Morty episodes function, where you're laughing, but behind the scenes, there's pathos or there's something weird. And that sounds very weird on a show that's just can be a goof ass thing, but it's like beneath all the sarcasm, there is quite a bit more going on. And that's the reason why the show sticks around instead of just being surface level jokes. And then Pat and I jammed on it, and we were lucky to be teamed up with Troy Little, who is genuinely one of the finest cartoonists in comics. He is a not given his due. He is one of the greatest comic artists around. His ability to tell a story, to stage characters, expressions. He is just a professional without peer. I love that guy. And his hard work on the series made it all work. We were throwing concepts at him that were just bonkers. And we were sending him so much reference material, because it wasn't just, we went through five editions of D&D in the story. So we were sending him first edition stuff versus second edition stuff versus, you know, like how deep cut can we go, you know, in these stories. And so that the deep fandom would know that we knew that we were speaking the same language. And my D&D collection is vast, and we were just digging into all the archives. And Pat is a phenomenal storyteller and had all these emotional ideas. And we were just smashing all this stuff together. And it was a really crazy book. And the what I loved was, when it was initially announced, there was a lot of cynicism. A bunch of people were really angry there were people that messaged and said, why isn't Pat working on the book that he's owed us? And there were other people that were like, oh, crossovers are garbage. And we knew we had a good book. We knew we had a fun book. We knew we had something. It sounds weird to be like with something to say with this cheap crossover corny concept. We were going to, you know, give you a left hook or whatever. And then the first issue came out and the reviews were bonkers. And everyone was like, this is good. Despite
the old backhanded compliment
crossoverism. Oh, yeah. In a played out kind of field of bad crossovers, this thing is shockingly good. And I put a lot of that to Troy's phenomenal artwork and Leonardo Ito's colors and Pat and I really kind of pushing each other at every step to make this thing feel like you were getting your cover in price worth. And it did stupidly well. It did stupidly well in trade. And then to the point where Wiz of the Coast reached out and said they were now talking to Adult Swim about doing a Rick and Morty D&D box set. They did a game set, which was D&D mm-hmm. versus Rick and yep. Morty, which was, and I worked on that and Troy did artwork for that. And then I thought we would be done. And I was at PAX Unplugged, which is the big kind of tabletop game show in North America. And I was signing tons of Rick and Morty D&D and Pat was there and we were chatting and I had an idea for a sequel. And I said, Pat, you came up with some of the big picture ideas for the first one. I've got the 10 post idea for the sequel. And I pitched it out and he loved it. And then like 2 weeks later, he's like, I am so backed up with work, but I give you my blessing. You go do it on your own. And so I wrote the sequel solo. Yep. And it was a blast. And I said, yeah. I couldn't do it without Troy. So they brought Troy back. And then we did one more special. We did a Meeseeks special, yes. the Meeseeks uh-huh. adventure. And that was this ludicrous thing where we just took a core concept of what if a Meeseeks got dropped in the Forgotten Realms? What chaos would kind of, you know, be unleashed. And Troy and I had so much fun with that. People assumed we were going to come back and do a trilogy, but we wanted to counter program. And so I pitched an idea for Rick and Morty versus Cthulhu. And we did that, you know, the other last year, we wrapped that sucker up. And that was super fun because we got to take the piss with H.P. Lovecraft and all the Cthulian kind of mythos and all these deep cut ludicrous things. And that was very, my initial knowledge comes from the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, yes. which turned me into a fan of the pulps, which turned me into a fan of, you know, like the genre. And so it was just fun to kind of come full circle with Troy and do that book. And the Rick and Morty stuff was a lot of fun to do. The best compliments I get are people are, you know, I wish this was animated. I can hear the voices of the characters coming out when I read the pages. That stuff is a joy to hear from readers, you know, and even from people I met who worked on the Rick and Morty stuff. They say it's one of their favorites in terms of whatever extended media tie-in kind of stuff that they've seen over the years, which is that's a pretty good compliment.
I do there are times, you know, because Rick and Morty is a constant, you know, you're like, oh, throw on an episode mm-hmm. of Rick and Morty, and it all it often surprises me that, you know, the D&D stuff isn't on the list as one of the episodes, because you're like, in your head it kind of is.
You know? So totally. And Troy's artwork is so visceral and so animated that it feels like it's exploding on the page between the panels. Like, you can write whatever you want, but if the artist isn't carry through on that potential, you're dead, you know? And being teamed up with amazing artists, of course, makes all the difference. And I would never throw anyone under the bus, but I immediately know which books I've been in sync with on the artist and which ones where we were kind of like the friction, and not in terms of communication, but just in terms of like style and messaging. And usually those come about when you have to write a script without knowing who's going to draw it. If you're just writing in a vacuum and you're like, the artist is to be determined and you're like, oh God, I just want to tell a good story. And I don't know if this is going to play to their strengths. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That can be really, really difficult.
And especially
sure. But when you go in knowing who the artist is going to be and you know they can deliver on the potential and hit the ground with it, you're just like, man, this is the best.
Especially I think with those sort of licensed properties like Rick and Morty or currently with Star Trek, we've talked about, you know, the artist is effectively, you know, it's the given the characters they're the actor, you know what I mean? So whenever I see a Captain Picard that doesn't look right. It totally takes you out of it.
Right.
You know, it doesn't look the way, it doesn't act the way.
Of yeah. Patrick Stewart. You're like, eh, it's not quite working
so,
for me. Yeah.
So exactly.
And that's tough. Likenesses are tough and all that stuff's mm-hmm. kind of tough. And with the show style, you definitely want to hit the mark with it. Yeah. So it feels like it's the animated series, 100%.
Yeah, and Rick and Morty is very, very signature. Very much has a style.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, well, I mean, talking about rabid fan bases such as Rick and Morty and Dungeons and Dragons, we move to another rabid fan base, and obviously you spent plenty of time at Marvel. You got to work on some really cool characters and events there. How was your time at Marvel?
Marvel's great. I mean, it was the weirdest feeling moving over from my first work at Marvel was actually, I was doing work for Bill Roseman. Bill Roseman is now the head of Marvel Games. So he's the guy who's sort of the interface between Marvel and the studios doing, like, you know, at Insomniac doing the Spider-Man games or Avengers or any of those other things. But Bill at the time was an editor who was in charge of what was called special projects. So he had been tasked with doing those Disney Kingdom books, which were sort of like right after Disney bought Marvel. Joe Quesada, I think, went out to a baseball game with some people from Disney, and they started talking about synergies and how could Marvel, instead of just, okay, Marvel's part of the Disney family, how can we start to make comics that are more intrinsic? And, you know, I guess Joe had said something to the degree of, you know, comics are an incredible proving ground for expanding creative ideas and throwing things against the wall and seeing what sticks. And so they said, you know, something like Pirates of the Caribbean, loosely based on the ride from Disney World, what if you took more of those kinds of park concepts and you tried to find stories for them, whether or not there was originally a story in mind? And one of them was Journey into Imagination, which is from the Epcot Center with that little purple dragon Figment. And Bill Roseman said, oh, there's a dragon in it. We need a fantasy guy. And so he reached out to me.
Brian strikes again.
The funny thing was, I wasn't a good fit for a traditional fantasy story, but my background is also in animation. And at the time, one of the courses I was teaching was animation history. And so I have a huge animation archive, and I know the character, and I know a bunch about the Disney park stuff. So I was the right choice, but not for the reasons he thought. And so I built this kind of fun all-ages steampunk kind of story that very much fit the vibe of the original ride concept art. And the fandom really took off. The Disney park fandom is like a subset of the larger Disney fandom, and they are wicked hardcore. And they love Figment. They grew up on Figment in the 80s, and they just have a lot of fond memories of that character. And so the first issue of this first miniseries for this line of books called Disney Kingdoms comes out, and it's sold out. I think there were 3 printings of the first issue and 2 printings of every issue in the miniseries. And Marvel didn't have any deep expectations on this line. You know, it ostensibly was a bit like a kid's line, you know, all ages-ish kind of stuff. And, you know, in the traditional comic store market, that can be a real mixed bag for people. And all of a sudden we had this hot little book. And so that gave Bill a little bit more kind of room to move. And he had given me some other kind of special projects, advertising comics and stuff that Marvel was doing, just to kind of give me more to do. And then that opened the door to do potentially more stuff down the line. And he and I were developing a concept that was supposed to launch just before the new Secret Wars series that Hickman was doing.
Yes.
And then because Bill found out that they were going to be rebooting a bunch of books and things like that, he was like, no, it's not a good time to do this book. We'll do it maybe during Secret Wars. I was like, okay. And then it was like, no, we'll do it after Secret Wars. I was like, okay. And so this idea just kept getting kicked down the road. And I was like, I'm going to do a Marvel superhero book. And then between that and Secret Wars wrapping up, he got the offer to take over Marvel Games and move to the West Coast, to California. And so he contacts me and he was like, Jim, I am so, so sorry. This pet project we've been working on, which I can't even tell you what it is, because it's like, it was a new kind of a team concept that had its own name. And we were taking a bunch of disparate Marvel characters and kind of smashing them together. Bill had been the editor on the Abnett and Lanning Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yep.
And the Guardians of the Galaxy movie had come out and been a big hit. So he had this idea of another kind of team of misfitty kind of weird characters, in the way that the Guardians were sort of pulling together little bits and pieces of Marvel cosmic, whatever, at the time when it was repitched. And so we were taking a corner of the Marvel universe and we were pulling all these little bits together. And then he was like, I'm leaving Marvel. I'm moving over to Marvel Games. No one else is going to hold water for this thing. It's a total pet project. And without me championing it, it's going to die. And he's like, I'm so sorry that, you know, you'll be paid for the development you've done and all this kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, it sucks. And what I didn't know is on his way out of the Marvel office, he talked to Tom Brevoort, who's, you know, longest running Marvel editor, head of the Avengers group. And he said, you know, Jim is one of the hardest working, most well-organized people I've ever worked with. Someone should hire him for a project. And Tom messaged me out of the blue and basically said, you know, Bill's a great guy and he doesn't normally give compliments this gushing about someone. Let's find a project for you here, you know, in the office. And it took a few months and a couple back and forths. And then all of a sudden, in the buildup towards Secret Empire, the Thunderbolts book there was a plan there. They had an idea with the book. And I think might have been Nick Spencer said something like, Bucky's going to lead the Thunderbolts. And that was it. It was like, Bucky's going to lead the Thunderbolts. And this little girl who's a shard of the Cosmic Cube is going to be in the mix.
Yep.
And Tom goes, that's the idea. Go with it. And I was like, okay. And so I put together a pitch and we did two or three back and forth. And all of a sudden I was going to be doing a monthly book at Marvel. And that was it. That was sort of my start. And Tom was really my way into the main Marvel universe. And I don't think there was a month that went by that I wasn't doing something in the Avengers office for like 3+ years. Mm. I went over from Thunderbolts and then I took over Uncanny Avengers from Jerry Dugan. Jerry moved over to Guardians of the Galaxy. And originally we were going to relaunch an Avengers book and then the plans changed and all of a sudden Jason Aaron was going to be relaunching Avengers with just one core flagship book. And so they had the idea to crush down 3 Avengers books into an event. And so that was US Avengers, Mark Waid's flagship Avengers book, and my Uncanny Avengers book, where all of a sudden we did this weekly book called No Surrender. Yes, and that was a crazy opportunity to kind of prove myself. And I got to write with Mark Waid and Al Ewing, and we had never met each other. And all of a sudden we did a conference. We actually flew into New York, went into the boardroom, and over the course of like 9 hours, broke the story on a 16-part weekly comic, and then went home and wrote all of it. Had 3 different artists simultaneously drawing chapters of the story. And, you know, Mark had done work on 52, but Alan had never done a weekly. We didn't know. I mean, delivering a book on a monthly basis is stressful. And all of a sudden we were going to, you know, increase production fourfold. What is that like? And it was like, here we go. Like it was this runaway train of insanity. And it was super fun because like my inbox right now is always chugging away with new artwork and with, you know, back and forth. And this was just like a torrential downpour of creativity, like just constant conversations and ideas and conference calls and fun in jokes that build up over any kind of working relationship you have with people. And Al and Mark are 2 of the best collaborators I've ever worked with. And it was basically like, whatever's right for the story. It wasn't about individual egos. It was like, let the best ideas win kind of stuff. And we didn't fight very much because we all kind of had, we knew if someone had a great idea, it was like, well, that's better than what I was thinking. So we're going to do that. Clearly that's the cooler concept. Or, you know, one of the weirdest ideas that we had that worked shockingly well was that, you know, on 52 and the other weekly books, one writer would write an entire script or write a group of scripts. And then they would sort of fuse the endings of one person's script with the next start of the next person's story. And we decided one of the problems with that was you could really tell the voice and the pacing was different. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. A Mark Waid issue of 52 reads very different from whatever a Geoff Johns issue or something like that. And their favorite characters are always going to come into the spotlight and whatever. And we wanted this very holistic kind of read that if you read an issue of No Surrender, it wasn't the Zub issue or a Ewing issue or a Waid issue. It was the story. And we wanted, so all of us collaborated on every single issue. We would write scene by scene. It would be like, well, there's more of my characters in the mix here. This feels like a Jim scene, or this feels like an Al scene, or whatever. And then after we all wrote the script, we would Frankenstein it together. And then we would keep pushing bits around. And, oh, that's a better line of dialogue for this big moment. I'm going to steal that from Al and put it on my page. And he's going to get this over here. And it was just like this wrestling match in the best way possible. Like, we're going to make this thing work. And when it came out, people couldn't tell who wrote which parts. And that was the whole point. You know, it was just good art. good, exciting story, big, cool character moments, and this relentless weekly kind of explosive pace. And for 4 months, we were the Avengers. We were, and this was as Infinity War was coming out. So Avengers is the biggest property in the world. And the writer, the co-writer of the Avengers is Canadian. So every outlet in Canadian news wants to talk to me about the Avengers because they think, well, I'm meeting Chris Evans or something. and we're talking about Avengers. And it was just super fun. And all of us kind of, the success of that book spoke us out to a bunch of other projects. Yeah. Mark would go over and do other stuff. Al started on Immortal Hulk because he pitched in the room at the boardroom table. Al pitched Immortal Hulk. Like, we were sitting around jamming Avengers stuff. And the night before, we flew into New York. And then, because they knew we were going to do a whole day in the office. So we flew in the night before the actual conference. And Al and Mark and I decided we would go for dinner just to meet each other because we'd never met. And we asked Tom if he wanted to come in. And I think he was, he's just far enough out of Manhattan that he was like, this is no, I'll see you tomorrow morning. And so we all met at a restaurant. And, you know, the first 25 minutes is awkward because we don't really know each other. And tomorrow we're going to be trying to make a story together. And by the end of dinner, we already felt like we were getting to know each other pretty good. And Al at dinner actually said to us, I'll do my best Al impression or whatever. He's like, you know, we were talking about favorite characters and things we'd love to do. And he goes, I've always wanted to do, I've got, you know, I've got some ideas for the, you know, for Banner. And we were like, what? You know, the big guy, Hulk. And we're like, oh my God, yeah? And he didn't tell us what it was. And he goes, you know, if there's there's a moment, if you see a moment, you could like, and Mark goes, you want us to tee you up? that would be lovely, you know? And so the next day, we're jamming like crazy and we're coming up with all sorts of stuff. And Axel Alonso, who's editor-in-chief at the time, he pops his head in the door and he goes, all right, I got the go-ahead. You guys can bring back the Hulk, because the Hulk was dead at the time. And Al basically like gets all nervous. And he's, oh, you know, about the Hulk. And Tom starts talking about, yeah, we don't know what we're going to do with the Hulk after this, but we just got to bring him back. And then someone will take it from there. And Tom goes, or sorry. And Al just goes, about that. And then he just like throws out the green door and like all this crazy Immortal Hulk stuff. And we're, our hair's blown back at the table because it's so crazy and awesome. And he gets like about 5 minutes into this pitch and he just sort of stops mid-sentence because this is the thing he really, really, really wants to do. And he gets this nervous tick in his voice and he starts to get even quieter and the whole room is dead silent. And Tom just looks over and goes, you're doing fine, Al. Just keep going. Cause we're hanging on his every word. We want to know what's coming next.
Wow.
And he finishes out this idea and Tom just nods and we're all just sort of like quiet. And he goes, well, I can't make any promises for the Hulk, but I sure like what you just said. So why don't we keep talking about that later? You know? And so I've probably signed more of those Avengers No Surrender, the Immortal Hulk first appearance issue.
Yeah.
Probably more than any other book I've ever signed. That's the one that people bring over to my table. And it's like, yeah, I wrote part of that issue, but like, it's Al's. Like, I have no, that's I got something. No horse in that race, you know. But just getting to work with him was brilliant. Getting to work with Mark, they're both delightful. Pepe Larraz, he was on the upswing at that moment. Mm-hmm. And Kim Jacinto and just all those guys. I got to work with Sean Isaac, my buddy. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just such a great, fun, collaborative air. And we literally, it was so funny. We were heading to New York Comic Con in October. The book was launching in January. And I think it had just been announced that with this weekly thing was happening in January or something like that. And we were working on the last script and we had delivered a script every 2 weeks so artists could just work away. And it was an insane production schedule because like Pepe's drawing the first four issues, I think, three or four issues. And so while issue one's being drawn, also issue four or five is being drawn by the next artist, Kim Jacinto. And then issue 9 is being drawn as well at the same time. And so we would have this crazy reference pool where whoever drew a location or a new thing that was in the story first, didn't matter what issue it was drawn in, that became the reference that everyone shared with each other. So And then we had weird things like, well, Quicksilver is going to get injured. All right, well, so we're drawing the aftermath of the injury before we drew the injury.
Yeah.
So make sure it matches the injury that, you know, Sean drew or whatever. It was just weird, crazy crap that was happening out of order to get the book all done. So we're heading to New York Comic Con, and we had delivered every script on time. We had hit every deadline. Every 2 weeks, we had delivered a script. Literally every Monday morning, it was like we would deliver, here's the next script, here's the next script. And Tom and Alana, Alana was the assistant editor at the time. Now she's a full editor at Marvel. They were, you know, pleased, and everything was roaring along. And we get to issue 16, and it's our epilogue issue, and there's so much heavy lifting. There's so much stuff we got to do. We got to shunt all these characters off to their next stories or set them up for new ideas. And we needed two extra pages, and I needed some extra time because we had New York Comic Con right in the middle of those 2 weeks to produce the issue. And so I sent an email to Tom, and I said, you know, I look at the pacing, and I just don't see how we can do this without two extra pages. We've never asked for any extra pages on any issue, but like it really helped this thing to not feel claustrophobic. And, you know, New York Comic Con's right in the middle of this thing, and I would love to have it done and we all high five that we're done, but this might be the last time I ever write the Avengers. I mean, it's the first time. Mm-hmm. I never thought I would ever get the chance. I kind of want to lavish a bit of extra attention on it. I hope you don't mind, Tom. We're going to miss our Monday deadline. Tom emails me back and he goes, well, I built 9 weeks of buffer into the schedule, assuming you guys were going to blow every deadline. So I guess you can take an extra week, you slack, you know?
Wow.
And that was the best compliment, you know? And so the books come out the week that issue 16 came out, the last issue, we got a gift in the mail. Tom had a special deck of cards printed up with the Grandmaster on the back of them. So everyone on the creative team, I think they only printed like 20 of them or whatever, has a deck of cards with the Grandmaster on it. It is like a celebration of our crew. And a letter from Dan Buckley, the president of Marvel, thanking us for our professionalism and hard work and whatever. And issue 16 comes out, and we're getting ready to go to C2E2. And I know I'm going to be signing stacks of all 16 of them or whatever. And Tom just emails back, like literally it was the day after the issue release. And he goes, well, now that you've had time to rest, let's do it again.
No road home.
You know, Endgame's going to be coming out and we've got extra bandwidth for the Avengers. Is everyone in? And I think Mark emailed back like 10 minutes later and just said, Avengers assemble. And we were like, all right, here we go again, you know? And so we did a 10-part story. You know, we did a weekly again. It was just bonkers. That's called No Road Home. And that was a ton of fun. And coming back to the Marvel office to do a second summit was like a victory lap. Like now we were all friends. Now we were all veterans and we'd all been through the war and we'd completed the thing. And so coming back for the second go around wasn't as intimidating. I didn't feel like the weak link in the chain. I was like, oh yeah, this is what we do. We just make crazy, cool, epic stories together because that's the job, you know? It's a very special memory for me. It's very, I loved working on Avengers. I loved working on that book. Our team was a delight and a lot of great friendships, you know, come out. Anytime someone brings one of those books forward, I get a real warm feeling about that project.
Yeah, I mean, the work you did on Avengers No Surrender and Avengers No Road Home, for me, was pretty seminal Avengers work.
Thank you.
It reminded me, and that's a high compliment. It reminded me very much of the fantastic Kurt Busiek, Curtis Pacheco, Avengers Forever.
Oh, thanks. Thank you. Thank you. That is a huge compliment. Yeah, whenever we show up on one of those best Avengers stories list, I'm sort of like, what? You guys are crazy. Like,
it just seems impossible. No, well deserved.
You guys have swearing on your podcast?
We have no problem.
Okay. I have to tell a story and it doesn't work unless I get the swearing. So one of the best compliments I've ever gotten on the book, I was at the Calgary Comic Expo and this old dude comes over. He's literally got a walker and he's like going around the show and he comes over to the table and he's like, he points at my banner and he goes, is that you? He's like, yep, that's me. And he goes, ah, and he gets his, I don't know if it was his son or his friend or whatever, pulls all 16 issues of No Surrender and just drops it in front of me to sign. He goes, this kid, I've been reading since Lee and Kirby. I was like, really? Oh, every issue of Avengers. I was like, okay. And he goes, this is some good shit. Yes.
Yes.
I was ecstatic to sign that guy's books. I was just like, well, he knows what he's talking about. So.
Brilliant. And I mean, I gotta say, we'll move on from Marvel now in a wee second, but Thunderbolts, no Thunderbolts as well. I mean,
yeah. Getting to do Thunderbolts twice was a joy. Getting to work with Sean and everyone on the team was great. I love the Thunderbolts. It's very, you can see when you read Skull Kickers, you can see why I got Thunderbolts, the kind of like action idiots, like getting themselves in deep and trouble. I liked playing up some of the a little bit darker, but some of the violent kind of ludicrous tendencies and putting them, bouncing them off each other.
Yeah.
I wish that original run had gone past 12. We had a bunch of crazy ideas and then Secret Empire kind of became this massive, you know, obviously ludicrous thing. And I was hoping we were going to bounce out of it with more bolts, but I'm really glad we did it. It was a lot of fun. And that was really my proving ground at Marvel. Yeah. And it, a lot of doors opened because of that run. So do have a pretty heartfelt.
Yeah. I have a soft spot for Thunderbolts. I've got the entire run. I remember, you know, the original run as well. I remember, you know, it stands to me, you know, that whenever you could still be surprised by something that was coming out in a comic book and that initial episode one, issue one revelation, you know.
Yeah, but one of the great things about a book like Thunderbolts, you know, don't get me wrong, I love working on Avengers. I love working on, obviously, these books that you can say the title to anyone and they recognize it. But the great thing about the kind of, they're not B tier, they're just lesser well-known books, you know what I mean? Is that people don't have etched in their mind an absolute, right? Yes. So you can change up the paradigm more and people, the readership will accept it more. You know, you can't mess with Spider-Man too hard or the fans will freak out. You can't mess with, you know, the Fantastic Four too hard or the fans will freak out. Like, everyone's used to the Thunderbolts being a mess. So your mess is going to be entertaining. Let's just make it the messiest, craziest, weirdest kind of version of things.
Yeah.
That's kind of where the fun stuff happens. You know, that's where, when a book is sort of like, no one knows what to expect. So you're like, check this curveball out. Let's go. Yeah. You know, that's where the fun stuff happens.
And it was, I mean, your more recent Thunderbolts run where Hawkeye was in charge, you know, after Devil's Reign. Yeah. I can't remember what it was. And that character that you created, the 90s throwback, was it Guts? You called him?
Yeah. Guts and Glory.
Yeah.
Guts and Glory. That was good fun.
I'm still waiting for his 4-issue miniseries. I need to know going on with that guy.
What was so fun about that was, you know, we were trying to pull together the concept for that book, and it was feeling so much like the dog's breakfast of who's going to be in this book and why. And then all of a sudden I just decided to front load it. I was like, what if that's the joke? What if it's like an assembled team that is a PR stunt? They wouldn't have pulled themselves together. It's all being built by people to try and create a product, because in some ways we're trying to create this product after Devil's Reign. And so it was like, we'll just say it, like, just lampshade the thing that we're doing, which is, this is, you know, there's the frontage of, they have to be this thing in the public eye. So we have to have one of these and one of those and one of these. And so, and then I, you know, at the time, like, Donnie's Venom book was huge and all this stuff. Yep. And it was like this idea of 90s retro was suddenly hot again. So I was like, let's throw a 90s character in. Well, which one? Let's make one, because that's the most 90s thing you could do, is just make up a new character on the spot that vaguely feels like a bunch of other characters. Like, I don't know if you remember that one summer when Marvel and DC both did making up tons of new characters to try and feed on the fire from the Image launches. So they had the, what was it called? It wasn't Young Bloods. It was like New Blood or something at DC. Yep. And it was like, in the annuals, they had a bunch of these new characters that no one wanted to see ever again. I don't think many of those characters went anywhere. But for one summer, they were like, see, we can do edgy, cool characters barely wearing any clothes or with cybernetic arms or, you know, whatever ludicrous crap. So I was just like, let's do one of those. Like, and thankfully, Sean, like, kind of drew above, went well beyond the Call of Duty when designing those characters and just making everyone. I told him, like, he got pulled into doing that book and he had just come off of Fantastic Four, and he literally told Marvel, they said, what do you want to do next? And he goes, anything but a team book. And then I called him up and I said, he loves Hawkeye, he loves archers, he loves Green Arrow, and he loves Hawkeye. And I was like, Hawkeye leading a team. And he was like, God damn it, Jim, you're gonna kill me. Like, I don't want to draw a team. And I was like, you get to design all the costumes. And he was like, all right, you know, it was like that class, like the Rick and Morty, all right, you son of a bitch, I'm in.
And now he's on Green Arrow for DC.
That's right. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, no, it's to go back to your point there, I mean, my personal favorite Marvel character is Daredevil. And it was really interesting when we talked to Chip about it, and he was saying the great thing about something like Daredevil, and you look at the people who have written Daredevil for the last 30, 40 years, you know, Frank Miller, Brubaker, Bendis, Nascenti, you know, Charles Soule, Mark Waid. But what Chip was saying was the great thing with something like that, and I'm sure Thunderbolts is something similar, is he get more control over your storytelling because Chip said, imagine I was writing Spider-Man, and Spider-Man accidentally kills a guy in issue 2. He would be kicked out of Marvel so fast. But he was able to do it with Daredevil because they're like, yeah, take the blind lawyer, do whatever you want.
Sure.
You know?
Well, and it's the nice thing is the Daredevil book's kind of its own little corner of the Marvel universe too, right? Technically it's street level, and so Spider-Man could show up and whatever other characters could show up, but Daredevil's always kind of been in his own space. You could just try stuff out. You can go kind of wild with conceptual ideas with it and push big dramatic concepts, you know, in the way that Frank did or all these other writers have over the years. And Chip's always been good at surprising people in terms of like pulling pathos out of this stuff or layering in a really good, you know, foreshadowed concept that he's going to pay off down the line. And it's funny because I've known him for a long time. I knew him when he was doing his indie comic stuff, and he was very much like troublemaking clown. Like the guy who drew Sex Criminals is the guy that I knew in comics. Do you know what I mean? Like this very much goof ass, don't take anything seriously kind of stuff. But then I knew we would talk about story stuff and he would have big ideas. And you're like, well, but no one wants that from Zdarsky. Zdarsky's the goofball, you know? And then he was Matt Fraction's kind of artistic collaborator on Sex Criminals. Yeah. And to see him now become this lauded writer who's was simultaneously doing Daredevil and Batman, like what the hell? You'd have told the Zdarsky of 15, 20 years ago, by the way, you will be one of the top people of comics. Even now to this day, when we chat, we go for dinner or whatever, he is so ill at ease with that aspect of his career. You know, he just doesn't. So he's sort of, his armor is the fact that he's still himself. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Sometimes comic fame isn't real fame. It's not like people recognize you on the street or things like that. But there's still a weird level of you're working on things that are intrinsic to people's whatever childhood and nostalgia and all that kind of stuff. And some people don't deal with that well, or the fandom or the intensity of it. And his whatever plot armor, I don't know what you want to call it, is the fact that he's still just kind of him, and he's still just like, well, this is what I'm going to do. Stop me. You know, here we go. I'm going over here. And I have times where I'm extremely jealous of it, where I wish I could be more kind of carefree about aspects of it. He's really good at that. And every so often, if I'm really stressed about something, he's a good person to bounce things off of, where I'm like, man, I'm freaking out. And he's just like, why? Don't worry about it, man. These things you can't control. Take care of stuff you can't control, you know? And I was just like, all right, words on the page. That's what you do. That's what you're going to make.
Thanks for joining us for part two of our mammoth interview with Jim Zub. Keep an eye on your pod feed for part three coming soon, where we talk Conan the Barbarian.
So, I've been Alan Taylor, and this has been Keith Miller.
You can find Alan in store at Coffee and Heroes most days, and on Twitter, where Alan is Coffee and Heroes 1 and I'm Ascanison00. Coffee and Heroes is a local comic book store, coffee shop, and community hub in Northern Ireland, based at Smithfield Market in the centre of Belfast.
You can also find Coffee and Heroes on Facebook and Instagram, or email us at coffeeandheroes@hotmail.com. Make sure to check out our YouTube channel as well.
Coffee and Heroes podcast is available on Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and through all good podcast platforms. Please like and subscribe and leave a review so more people can find us.
And until next time, happy reading, and hope to see you in store soon.